ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's alliance with the United States has been the linchpin of our country's foreign policy for decades.
We value the unbroken friendship between the Australian and the American peoples.
But between the wars and the tariffs and the unpredictability, are we growing apart?
You know who else didn't help us? Australia.
Join me, Hamish McDonald.
And me, Geraldine Doogue, as we ask, do we still need the alliance? Search for Global Roaming on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. I'm David Maher. We think of archaeologists hard at work with their little spades and sieves in Roman ruins, but a few years ago in Queensland, they set to work on the remains of native police camps in the bush. The result? A new understanding of the lives of those Europeans and Indigenous who served in this violent force on the Australian frontier. That later, but first... On August the 5th, 2013, a man and a woman ate a burger. These are not my words, ladies and gentlemen, as I'll explain in a moment. Not just any burger, a world historical burger made from cattle cells grown in a lab. The cost of the burger, $330,000. The taste, not great. At that time, enthusiasm for lab-grown meat was driving an investment boom. Hundreds of millions of dollars were at stake, and the planet was to be saved from farting cows. A couple of years ago, Jeff Bezos tipped another $30 million into the research for lab meat. But as my guest and author of the above quote, Erin Summers, reports in this month's issue of Harper's Magazine, it's all rather fallen in a heap. Erin, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
I love the detail that that burger, that $330,000 burger, wasn't even finished.
They left some of it on the plate. I couldn't believe it.
What did it taste like? What do reports say it tasted like?
It tasted like some kind of meat cake, according to one of the people who tried it. So a slightly bland approximation of meat. The reason for that, which the article gets into, is that the burger was made of pure muscle cells. So there was no fat in the burger, and the fat provides the richness, in a burger or a steak. So it was a little on the bland side.
And as you point out in the piece, if you want to make a slab of something that tastes like meat, it's got so many different things in it. It's not just one thing. It's fat, it's meat, it's gristle, it's the lot. And you can't grow that in a tank, can you?
No, not yet anyway. Currently, you can only grow a single type of cell in a single vessel at a time. So you can grow the muscle cells or you can grow the fat cells, but you can't grow them together. So you can't grow a steak as you'd find a steak on your plate. You know, it's just not possible yet. So to approximate that, they have to isolate the different parts and then extrude them into a steak shape via 3D printing. And that's how they're sort of getting close these days.
Yes, let's make clear that we're not talking about the kind of, you know, fake cutlets that vegans buy that are made of plant cells. That's not what we're talking about here at all, is it?
No, those are made from alternative proteins like pea protein, lentils, beans. They're colored with beet juice and all sorts of other ingredients. But we're talking actual animals from cells here.
Right. What got you hooked on this story? It's rather out of your ordinary field, isn't it? When I say
it's
ordinary,
not...
I'm sorry. it's rather out of your specialist field.
Sure, it's not my beat at all. I typically write when I write nonfiction, I typically write about books or culture. But this came to my attention a few years ago when I think the first spark might have been an Australian company actually called Vow created this meatball out of mammoth cells. Like they took out cells from a fossil and they grew them into this burger. And it was a stunt. No one was allowed to eat it because they couldn't determine whether it was safe to eat cells from something that old. And I thought, this is really fascinating. This is such an oddity and such a carnival sideshow. And they were making all these bombastic claims. And so I just started keeping my eye on it. And I followed it for a few years and until eventually Harper's Magazine came to me and said, are you sitting on anything you'd like to write about or anything you'd like to investigate? And I said, well, actually, I have the weirdest idea in the world. And here we are.
and indeed, here we are. And of course, you have a very personal stake in this, don't you, as a vegetarian?
Yeah. So complicating matters is that I haven't eaten meat. Prior to writing this piece, I hadn't eaten meat in around 20 years. I think it's 19 or something. And so I was rooting for the fake meat. I thought, you know, maybe this is the answer to so many of our issues, our food systems issues and our environmental issues. And perhaps it could, you know, fill a niche for people like me, like vegetarians who, you know, have become vegetarians for a constellation of reasons, but are not necessarily attached to the whole thing. So I was very excited to taste it. And as I embarked on the journey to try to find it, it dawned on me that it was nearly impossible, that the product barely existed.
But yes, you're one of those vegetarians who miss meat. And perfectly reasonable, perfectly sensible, you wanted to find an ethical substitute. But, Erin, what did you find? I wonder whether you see parallels here between the sort of investment enthusiasm for lab meat and the hundreds of millions of dollars thrown at lab meat and the, you know, thousands of billions of dollars now being thrown at AI. It's sort of throwing money after an enthusiasm for developing something new.
Yeah, I see a lot of parallels. It's sort of like an investment hysteria, right? When there's not necessarily a product yet or a functional product or a there. You know, there's not the substance to back it up, but there's this fervor and one investment begets the next investment, but the product never really pans out. And I think that this is sort of a big theme of tech, at least in the US and probably worldwide, where it's like there's a real feeling that it's a confidence game, that there is, you just go looking for the product and it just never really arrives.
Let's go back to the beginning. Who first started spruiking for lab-grown meat? When did this whole possibility first, you know, arrive on the horizon?
So as you were reading, the current boom really started with Mark Post, who is a researcher and professor in the Netherlands, who was the first one who first theorized this burger grown completely in a petri dish, and he delivered it in 2013. And there was this big moment of theater where a lot of journalists came out and it was broadcast online and you could watch people taste the burger. And after that, that sort of, you know, unsurprisingly, triggered a huge amount of investment, just a huge boom and money poured in. And it seemed like this was it. This was going to be a huge breakthrough in our food systems. And this was going to be sort of like the fix to the cattle farming industry, which has done so much damage to our environment. And as time wore on, though, the product never sort of arrived. So there's something I talk about in the article, which is this way of tracking, you know, innovation and investment and interest in innovation. And it's called the Gartner hype cycle. And so first there is an investment boom and then interest falls off and you fall into a trough and then you kind of climb back out and you're on a plateau and science innovates from there, and it's just slow and steady from there. So at first there was a huge boom and a ton of interest, and then it fell off and there was a dip. And just now, finally, 15 years later, we're climbing out of that, hopefully. And slowly but surely, small innovations are being made on the road to this lab-grown meat that may or may not arrive.
So it begins with an academic, it begins with a university and a demonstration of what had been grown in a university lab. But what about turning it into an industrial process? Has there been any success here? I mean, there was a very promising company, it was seen promising, with Israeli backing. What happened to that?
There's a company called Believer that was based in Israel, and they built a huge factory in North Carolina that I attempted to visit for the purposes of this article. And it was state of the art, all this brand new technology. And they no longer make the meat one petri dish at a time. It's now these huge, huge vats, basically more akin to a beer brewery or something like that. So they built this. It cost millions and millions of dollars. And just as they were about to get off the ground, they got certain approvals here in the U.S. It seemed very promising for the industry. It seemed like they had figured out how to scale, which has been a huge problem. And just as they were set to turn the lights on and start pumping the chicken out, the news broke. And as I was there in North Carolina, the news broke that the company had gone bankrupt. So then it was just the factory was just locked up and sitting there with all this groundbreaking technology inside. So they have gotten close, and a few startups have gotten close and figured out the processes and figured out how to scale, but no one has quite managed to do it yet to get like a large scale operation off the ground.
What's the problem? What is proving difficult to do at scale?
It's very expensive. First of all, the processes are expensive and the equipment is expensive. The workforce is not really there yet. They're developing the science sort of in real time, and people lack the training. So it's training a workforce, it's the cost, it's meeting growth hurdles in time to satisfy VCs. You know, it's like they're trying to investors have all these ideas about how fast companies should grow and how fast companies should scale, which makes companies want to grow faster than they can. And then they go bust because it was too ambitious of an operation. And so we're seeing a lot of that.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Aaron Summers, who is the author of the cover story in this month's Harper's Magazine about the trials and tribulations of lab-grown meat. Aaron, it's also become a focus of the culture war in the United States.
That's right. So a number of right-wing politicians in seven states have passed laws making it illegal to produce and or sell it in those states. And it's actually kind of funny if you know anything about it, because the industry is so nascent, it is so young, and it is so small that it poses not a shred of a threat to the cattle industry and the beef industry and the chicken industry. That poses not a threat at all. So it is this sort of invented or cooked up threat to just, drive a wedge between the perceived, environmentalists and left-wing do-gooders on one side, and on the other side, real beef-eating Americans.
Yes, the Americans for whom Donald Trump has abolished tariffs on beef so that hamburgers, tasty hamburgers, will remain cheap.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of that kind of thing. It's a lot of theater, and, it's just legislation for an issue that does not exist.
Okay, so that at a time when the air was really going out of this balloon, Jeff Bezos turns up and chucks in a lazy $30 million. Now, why has he entered it? This is a couple of years ago. Why has he come into the field? What's he on about?
Oh, the question of why, I could only guess at, but I can only imagine that he sees a future for some of these products, or sees this research going somewhere. So he invested $30 million in the Bezos Lab, which is in conjunction with North Carolina State University. It's They study sustainable proteins. So not just cultivated meat, but, you know, every alternative you can think of, those other types of burgers we were talking about, just like alternative burgers. And I don't know why he's decided to invest, but, you know, it's welcome.
Right. So you visited that lab. Now, what did you find there?
Well, it was very new. It was just being set up, and I toured it. And everyone I dealt with there was wonderful, earnest, patiently explained these very complicated scientific processes to me. And then when we toured the lab, there was not much to see yet. You know, they had these huge printers and extruders that they used for printing out the meat and working on the problems of texture, but nothing was operational yet.
It does sound an awfully long way away from actually being a market. Is there anywhere in the world where you can buy lab-grown meat?
You can buy it at this place called Huber's in Singapore, which is a specialty butcher. During this article, when at my most desperate, I asked my editor, should we try to acquire the Huber's shredded lab-grown chicken on the gray market? And she said, hold your horses. Let's not, you know, let's not get on Silk Road yet looking for, you know, the cultivated meat.
You should have demanded to be flown to Singapore. I mean, I think you've lost an opportunity here. You could have tasted it. Have you?
Magazine budgets aren't what they once were.
No, but I know. But have you had any reports of what that meat tastes like? Does it? For instance, this may be a really ambitious question, does it taste like chicken?
I think it does. I mean, about that particular product at Huber's, I have not seen any reports, but a similar product from Upside Foods, a chicken patty that they made into like a breaded chicken sandwich, was tasted by the YouTube personality Mr. Beast in a video with very many views. And he did a blind taste test with, you know, the conventionally made chicken from a chicken and the cultivated chicken, and he could not tell the difference. So if you believe that YouTube personality, Mr. Beast, is sincere, it tastes pretty much like the real thing.
But you did taste some of this lab-grown meat, and did it make you want to go back for more?
I did finally taste it, and my reaction to it was a bit of an anticlimax. I think I was expecting to either be disgusted or be really impressed. And what I found was sort of similar to what people found when they tasted the first burger, which is it is akin to meat. I tasted a pork meatball. It tasted similar to what, you know, I remember meat tasting like, but it was a little bit on the bland side. But the thing that was the real hurdle for me was knowing too much about how it had been made. You know, I had been educated on this process and I had learned everything about it. And I knew too much to enjoy myself. So it was a little bit nauseating.
Yes. And you write about walking for hours around the town to try and get that sense of nausea under control. But it was not the taste, it was the knowledge. And isn't that going to be true for would-be customers?
I think it will be if people bother to find out about it. But I'm not sure that they will. I'm not sure that if it's simply next to, you know, a veggie burger, a synthetic burger on the grocery store shelf, I'm not sure that they're going to probe too deeply. They might just be willing to try it. An interesting thing that happened when I was researching this is that I saw a child eating it in Berkeley at a tasting, the same meatball I had, and the child was totally cool with it. You know, the child didn't know it was, she was maybe 3 years old. And I thought, see, that's a good test case because she doesn't know anything and she's eating it, you know, totally happily. So
children will eat dirt, Erin.
Well, that's true.
But hey, now look, what we should sort of talk about is actually how this lab grown meat is grown. I mean, what are the raw materials and what's the process?
So they extract cells from an animal. In the case of the pork meatball I ate, they took cells from the belly of a pig in upstate New York, kind of near where I live, a pig named Don. And then they grow them in, you know, it's just the same process that cells are grown in medical procedures, basically, where the cells are just put in a container and they divide and grow. And in this case, it's done, as I mentioned, in sort of like beer brewing containers, almost these huge stainless steel bioreactors. And then, you know, they grow at a certain rate. And when they have reached maturity and reached capacity, then the containers are drained and the matter is extracted. It comes out in like a pink slurry form, so like a semi-solid form. And then they have to take that matter and either 3D print it or otherwise constitute it into a form that you would recognize. So like then they turn it into a meatball by whatever means, whatever shaping means. Yeah, and that's how it's made. And then it can be cooked.
I don't detect any great, I was going to use the word appetite. I've got to use the word appetite. Any great appetite for developing lab-grown meat in Australia. I mean, there's nobody sort of, you know, writing articles about when can we get it, et cetera, et cetera. Is there a real, you know, enthusiasm for appetite for this meat in America?
No, I don't think that there necessarily is. I think that there is a small population of people like me who are curious about it and curious about it as a climate change solution and also curious about it as sort of a sideshow, you know, or a microcosm of what is happening in tech and what is happening in sort of food science. But no one here is clamoring either. I mean, when I talk to friends and acquaintances, when I was off reporting on this, they asked me where I was, what are you up to? And I was like, I'm reporting on cultivated meat. And they're like, what is that? What are you even talking about? This is like the weirdest possible answer you could ever give us. So I think that people mostly don't know about it. And then if they do know about it, they, you know, it's a shrug and it's a, that's weird.
So in the end, is it, and I apologize for this, is it just pie in the sky?
I think that these products will work their way into our food systems and become sort of niche products that you see alongside these burger alternatives and these chicken nugget alternatives in the freezer case. But I think it'll be a much smaller scale conclusion than the scientists once dreamed. I don't think that it is sort of the revolution that a few people envisioned. I think that it will become a modest part of our food system.
Erin, thanks so much for joining us on the show. Erin Summers' article, Where's the Beef? The Lab-Grown Meat Revolution That Wasn't, is the cover story in this month's Harper's Magazine, and it's completely wonderful. Erin, thanks for joining us on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, unearthing the secrets of the native police. About 10 years ago, academics from six universities began work on a mighty project that became the website Frontier Conflict, which from 2020 has been a first port of call for everyone investigating colonial violence in Australia. There is remarkable material there, scholarly papers, maps, photographs, oral histories from both sides of the frontier. And that material has now been brought to order in a fine book, Buried: Archaeology, Frontier Conflict and the Queensland Native Police. Its authors are three key academics in the field: Bryce Barker of the University of Southern Queensland, Lindley Wallace of Griffith University, and my guest today, Heather Burke, Professor in Archaeology at Flinders University in South Australia. Heather, welcome to the show.
Hello, David. Thanks for having me.
Let's establish some basics. Who were the native police?
Such a small question, such a big answer.
A few volumes in that answer.
Well, indeed, and I think that's one of the reasons our project took so long. It's kind of easy to summarise if I said that the Native Mounted Police were a paramilitary frontier policing force whose job was to make the frontier safe for white settler colonists and to facilitate all of the industries that those colonists were seeking to establish and exploit. That would be the short answer. The complicated answer is that once you start to unpack that force as a group of human beings across 80 years, which is a long time span, and across all of the colony of Queensland, you start to go down many rabbit tunnels, rabbit warrens of individual stories and people and places and times. So would you like the long answer or the short answer?
No, because those rabbit warrens are like the warrens before myxomatosis in this country, but just a few essential details. So while there were forces rather like the native police set up briefly in South Australia and in Victoria, we're essentially talking about northern New South Wales and Queensland, aren't we?
We are. So we're talking about initially a small group, so one white officer and about, I can't even remember the numbers now, 14 to 16 Aboriginal troopers who came from Victoria and were established in what is now the border of Queensland, so around Gundawindi. But at the time it was all New South Wales because this was in 1848. So it started with a small group, but it expanded from there because their success was such that the pastoral expansion northwards into what later became Queensland and westwards depended on their presence.
So, Heather, here's a force that operated for 80 years. So, of course, there's extensive records. This is a government force reporting to the police commissioner, and there must be extensive records of the work it did in Northern Australia, yes?
If you think about the kinds of records that are kept by government bodies, they're essentially bureaucratic records, right? So they're records of store orders or requests for leave of absence or transfers of people between locations. And they're the kinds of documents we have, certainly. There's lots of those. There are some documents that are about some of the patrols that Native Mounted Police detachments carried out, but most of the information about actually what went on outside of camp, so outside of all of those bureaucratic details of who bought what or ordered what or didn't get what or needed what, most of that information isn't in archives. It probably never made it to archives for whatever reason, and there would be a set of reasons for that. So there's no smoking gun in any of that documentation. There are various fragments we can put together, and some documents are more enlightening than others, but most of them are very prosaic.
So somebody came up with the idea of going to the sites of the police, native police camps, and doing what you do when you're investigating the time of Rome or Greece. You dig. Whose idea was it, Heather, to go out there and dig to find out what the native police were up to?
I have to confess it was mine, David. But it came about, can I sort of step back a bit?
Yes.
It came about because all of us had worked in Queensland for many decades. And independently, what we found was that whenever we worked with Aboriginal groups in different parts of Queensland, the stories that they often wanted to tell us were about the frontier conflict period. So even if we were there to do a different job or to talk about different kinds of sites, almost inevitably, those stories would come out about an ancestor who survived a massacre or a location where people had been killed. And that sort of sat in the backs of all of our minds because that was clearly important to Indigenous communities or those people that we worked with. And it sort of festered there for a long while until I did think one day we should do something about this. We should actually do some archaeology and try and collect these stories, because with more and more passing time, those people are dying, those stories change, those stories are lost. And I don't really know why it came about when it did, but literally I was driving home from work one day and thought we should do this project, and then I contacted my colleagues and we went from there.
How easy, how difficult has it been to locate the camps themselves or what's left of the camps?
Well, some were easy, some were very difficult, some we didn't find at all, and some we haven't even tried to look for. So probably in all, we know that there are at least around 160 Native Mounted Police camps across Queensland. And they're the ones that we can identify from records. So there would have been other temporary camps that never made it into any document that haven't been named. We didn't try and find all of those, but we started with what we did know. So one of our colleagues, Nolene Cole, had worked for many decades in far north Queensland in the area around Laura. And she'd already done some work on one Native Mounted Police camp near there, the Lower Laura camp. So we knew that existed and we knew where it was. We also knew that there was one out near Boolya, far southwestern Queensland, because it's a site that anyone can go to. They can drive there and have a look at it. So we started with the ones that we already knew the location of and then spent a lot of time trawling through archival maps to find any reference to any Native police camp anywhere and talking to lots of local communities, lots of landholders, lots of historical societies, anyone who we thought might be able to give us a lead.
How long were these camps occupied for?
Well, it varied. Some were short, some were only a few months. Some were decades. So there's no consistency, really, in terms of what a camp was, what it looked like, how long it was occupied for, or how many people were in it. All of those things varied according to the time period, the iteration of the Native Mounted Police that we're talking about, because it changed, its nature changed slightly over time, and whereabouts in Queensland we're talking about.
We know what they looked like, because there are, in fact, many photographs of the camps, with the troopers lined up in their best clothes, often with wives. So we know what they were built of, their shape. But none of that looks as though it would have survived long. They're bark huts.
Well, I always seem to be the devil's advocate in these conversations. We know there are photographs of some sites, but very few compared to the 160 we know existed. Uh-huh. So there are lots of photos of the Lower Laura camp, yes, absolutely, with rows of troopers and wives and children. There are some other photos of at least one other known camp and another camp, we're not sure which one it was, but there aren't that many. But yes, you're right. The troopers were all Indigenous, so they were all taken from an area of the colony, either New South Wales and Victoria or Queensland, where, taken from a different part into the areas that they were serving. But the troopers, because they were Indigenous, they were paid very little and they were expected to live in an Indigenous way, if that makes sense. So they weren't given high-end accommodation. They were basically building their own huts and those huts were very temporary, but then so were the houses that the officers were living in, because many of these camps were designed to exist for a short while and then simply have that detachment move on, because once they'd done their job, once they'd pacified that region, they were no longer needed and they needed to go further west or further north to do it again and again and again.
And I presume you took your spade to one of the camps that had lasted longer.
I took my trowel and my buckets and my sieves and all my friends and many students to do the labour.
Of course, yes. Student labour is a key to this, ladies and gentlemen.
Students are marvellous. They are the best thing ever. But yes, so it was kind of a process of winnowing down. We started out with how many camps were there, how many can we identify at least semi-reliably to a small portion of Queensland, because you know how huge Queensland is, it's not possible to look at all of it. How many of those can we actually find on the ground? So we spent a lot of time in different places, simply walking over the ground, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, to see if we could locate the site. The best ones were the ones that people already knew where they existed, and that was mostly landholders who could take us to the spot.
But if they didn't know exactly where, what was the clue? What was the clue that told you this is where a camp was?
The artifacts we could see on the surface, right? So only if there were surface artifacts, things that we could identify and things that we could reasonably assume related to the Native Mounted Police and not to any other kind of occupation. And the key artifacts there are uniform buttons and then ammunition, particularly from the Snyder Enfield rifle, which was used by the Native Mounted Police between 1870 and 1890.
Right, right, right. So you found the camp. Tell us what happened when you started to dig. What did you find?
Well, once we'd found some camps on the ground, we chose to excavate eight of them. And we chose them because they were from different time periods and in different places, and we wanted to get different phases of that story about life in camps for Native Mounted Police detachments. I don't know, have you ever seen, it's very old now, but I don't know if you ever watched Time Team when it was current many, many years ago.
No.
But one of the first things that archaeologists often do in an area, so if we found surface material that was indicative, we then want to know whether there was more that we couldn't see below the ground, right? Because we're obviously restricted by vegetation or by the amount of material that's exposed. So we spend a lot of time in these sites doing a geophysical survey, which uses a ground penetrating radar and a couple of other devices to try and see below the ground surface to see if there are any anomalies that we think could be cultural, that could be things like rubbish pits or footings or anything that doesn't seem to be part of the natural environment. That helped us decide where to dig, and so did whatever we could see on the surface if places were eroding, and then we, started excavating.
So what did you find? I mean, were you essentially going through rubbish tips?
Yes.
Right. So you were looking at what had been thrown away. And what did that tell you about the men, the women, the children?
Yeah. So the largest quantity of material came from that lower Laura camp, because it just turned out to have so much more material than other sites and more than we expected. So we excavated many trenches at Lower Laura. And what it gave us was the kind of domestic material that is quite anodyne in that story of frontier conflict. You know, it's about what they ate from or what they drank their tea from or the meat that they ate, you know, the bones they threw away, the pipes they were smoking, the things that they were drinking or putting on the table. All of these very ordinary domestic tasks, these chores, cleaning, eating, sleeping, building, whatever. So in many ways what we found is no different to what you would find in any 19th century site, apart from the large numbers of ammunition that were in some of those trenches and the uniform components that clearly came from Native Mounted Police uniforms.
Yeah. It sounds a bit careless if the bullet's alive.
Very few alive.
We're talking about cartridges.
We are. So we're talking about lead projectiles, either spherical or bullet-shaped, so depending on the time period, because, again, we won't go into it, but weapons technology changed rapidly and in many different directions over the course of the second half of the 19th century. So you've got lots of different weapons coming in and out of use quite quickly. Some of those bullets hadn't been fired at all, so they had been dropped or lost or thrown away or whatever without being fired. But there were also lots of cartridges, empty cartridges, that clearly had come from fired ammunition.
What did it tell you about kids in the camps?
Well, Lower Laura was interesting because it was the one camp that did contain toys, which wasn't something that we'd expected to find. Like, we did expect to find the remains of rubbish dumps or what they'd, you know, the blacksmith's smithy or whatever. But we didn't ever expect to find the remains of children quite that materially in the camp. So we know that many Native Mounted Police officers were married and that their wives lived with them in the camps, and that many of them had families that moved from camp to camp with their father as he was transferred. In Lower Laura there was a lovely little doll's head, a little porcelain doll's head, and the remains of a toy gun, like a cap gun, that
love that detail, a toy pop gun.
Yeah, and this gorgeous little tea set, little white porcelain tea set with a tiny little set of cups and little saucers. You can just imagine the children having imaginary tea parties, but out in the middle of nowhere.
And these are white kids. They're not the kids of the troopers.
Yes, these are white kids. So those material remains, those toys, were found in the rubbish dumps that were associated with the officers' quarters rather than the troopers' huts, which were in a different area of the camp.
Ah, so you were able to distinguish between those two. How describe the difference between the two rubbish tips?
Well, so it was relatively simple at Loa Laura because, as I said, our colleague Nolan Cole had worked there for many years. So the old men that she'd worked with had identified different areas of that camp as belonging to different parts of that organisation. And when we excavated the rubbish dumps, it bore that out. So all of the ceramics, all of the lovely broken plates or soup tureens or teacups, whatever, all of the ceramics pretty much were found in the area that the old men had identified as the officers' quarters. Very little ceramics in the troopers' hut area. Lots of tobacco pipes, though, in the troopers' huts area. None of the toys. I think there was one marble. We don't know how that one marble got in there, but only one marble right. in the troopers' huts areas. And different faunal remains, so different meat sources that are being consumed in each area.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Heather Burke about her work as an archaeologist in the Queensland Native Police camps and about the book, which is just about to appear, Buried, Archaeology, Frontier Conflict and the Queensland Native Mounted Police. Now, Heather, you found bottles, lots and lots of bottles.
We did, yes.
So who was on the piss?
Well, devil's advocate again, if you think about 19th century medicine and medical care, particularly out on the fringes, on whatever we want to call the frontier, those areas which are nowhere near towns or centres of settlement, everyone had to treat themselves, right? Everyone had to look after their own health as best they could. So it's always a contentious area whether alcohol that you find in sites is being drunk because there are lots of alcoholics there, or because things like the brandy, the schnapps, the gin is being used for medical purposes, because all of those things were perfectly normal medicinal drinks. Like they were parts of local cures for many different ailments.
But if we look at the records of Native police officers, very frequently, there is a record of alcoholic decline in these men.
There
looks to me as though they drank a good deal to do the work they did.
Yes. I mean, that is what we argue as well. I mean, alcohol was quite commonly drunk. It is still quite commonly drunk, right? There's large quantities of alcohol bottles I'm sure you would find associated with many domestic sites now, just as you would in the 19th century, with the caveat that a lot of that alcohol might have been used for medicinal purposes in the 19th century, more so than now. But yes, starting with Frederick Walker, the first commandant of the Native Mounted Police in 1848 and 49, there are lots of records that suggest Native Mounted Police officers drank far more than they should, and certainly not for medical purposes. Many of them had to be shifted to camps that were a long way from any source of resupply, and very carefully managed because it was very dangerous to have Native Mounted Police officers who were drunk on duty or while on patrol, because they'd also give that alcohol to the troopers.
A detail I loved, that many, many, many of these bottles were bottles of Wolf's Schnapps. And when I was a kid, you could still see ads for Wolf's Schnapps painted on railway bridges and things. But Wolf's Schnapps has completely disappeared, hasn't it?
Yeah. And if you'd ever read any of the advertisements, like if you look at historic newspapers, it's advertising all the medicinal benefits of it, right? Saying it will solve every possible problem that you could possibly have. Drink more schnapps.
And it was pure alcohol.
Yeah. Yep. So schnapps and gin, lots of that in both sites, and then in all of our sites, but also bottles of probably beer. It's difficult to tell what all bottles held, because you can't, unless it's like schnapps or gin, which have a particular shaped bottle, which is very distinctive, lots of different kinds of alcohol could come in the same sorts of bottles. But yes, probably lots of beer as well.
I must be giving the impression that your book is all about digging in old camps, but it's not, is it? Because what you discover in the camps is part of a much bigger picture of who you've been able to speak to, mapping, etc., etc., etc. But the discovery of the campsites themselves and their place in the landscape, what did it tell you about the work of the police? where the camps were.
Yeah, that was really interesting. There's so many moving parts to the story, so many elements to the story. It was quite difficult to try and unpack that from all of the different bits of information that we collected. But in trying to work out where the Native Mounted Police were, how many camps there were, the number just grew exponentially. So there, we now know that there were many more camps than we thought existed, and we now know they were in most parts of Queensland, if not all, and we know that there were more in some parts of Queensland than others. So there was obviously more intense need for that frontier violence in certain parts of Queensland, and we can only assume that was to do with Aboriginal resistance and the particular landscape features which allowed that resistance to continue, which sort of facilitated people being able to hide and find refuge.
Was there a particular place in the landscape where the camps were built? What determined where a camp was?
So if you think about the Native Mounted Police and the point of their existence, it was to facilitate that settler colonial expansion and all the industries that went with it, particularly pastoralism, but also mining, because that's what saved the Queensland colony from bankruptcy at one point. So those Native Mounted Police camps both went in advance of that settlement in terms of pastoral districts. So whenever a new pastoral district was declared, the Native Mounted Police were shifting their camps further and further out to accommodate that pastoral expansion. But also when there were new mineral fields discovered, the Native Mounted Police were there with the miners to protect them from any Aboriginal aggression, not necessarily to protect the Aboriginal people at all from white aggression, which of course we know is happening in both cases.
But these were base camps, not forts.
These were. So there's nothing like a fort at all in Queensland. So it's not a frontier in the same way that we imagine the American West or anything like that. It was never that kind of fortified line of, redoubts that protected villages and protected the inhabitants of those forts. These were just camps. They were largely ephemeral, like we said before. They were made from reusable materials, local materials. And whenever a detachment was moved, often that camp was pulled down and whatever was reusable was taken with them to the next camp. But because there were detachments of Native Mounted Police, mounted's the key word there, with horses, they needed a certain set of conditions in order to be able to function effectively, because you've got to make sure that the horses are in good enough condition to patrol. And obviously you've got to have water for the camp, so they needed permanent water, they needed good grass, and they needed to be somewhere where communications could go back and forth from them to headquarters, so orders could be relayed, but also where white settlers could find them if they needed them. So they had to be accessible as well. So they were often the ones, even though they were on the outskirts of settlement, they were often the ones who were setting up those travel routes or establishing those roads into new parts of the colony.
So you didn't put a camp in a remote location. That was pointless. It had to be where people could get to you quickly.
But it still was a remote location, David, because we're not talking about near towns. I mean, some were close to towns, but as those towns grew, those camps needed to move further and further away, and largely that was the danger of alcohol. But, yeah, no, we are talking about remote areas. We're talking about places where there might be pastoral stations, but they are widely dispersed, occupying or squatting on enormous areas of land with very few white people to speak of.
When did the last Native Police camp close?
Well, that was Cowan, and that was 1928. So if you think 1848, when Walker first went down to recruit his troopers in Victoria on the border, New South Wales, Victorian border, to 1928, that's the time span we're talking about.
Was ever a Native Police officer prosecuted for killing Indigenous?
No. So some, a very small number, we're talking hundreds of officers over the time span of that force, and the number you could count on one hand, pretty much, of officers who ever didn't go to trial necessarily. Some of them, they just went to a magistrate's hearing to see if there was enough evidence to send them to trial. None of them were ever prosecuted at all.
What about for kidnapping Aboriginal children?
Nope.
Kidnapping was rife, however?
Yes, because from what we can tell, acknowledging that there's very little documentation on the troopers at all. So we often have numbers of troopers, so we can say that at this camp at this time there were 11 troopers or 8 troopers or 12. But there's very, very little to tell us who those men were, even what their names were, let alone where they came from or how old they were. But from the few fragments that we have assembled, it seems like many of those men were young when they were taken into the Native Manor Police. Many of them stayed for a long time, though, so they were old by the time they left, but they were, young when they came in. And there are certainly stories of children being taken after massacres and being brought into the Native Manor Police camp to be raised there.
How do you find the descendants of those Aboriginal troopers deal with the knowledge that someone in their family was employed in killing other Indigenous?
It's not simple, is it, or straightforward, and it's the same for the descendants of white officers who have to engage with that internal conversation as well, of course. Look, some Aboriginal people have said, well, everyone acknowledges that it's a complicated area, but some have also acknowledged that that process weaponized any existing antagonisms between Aboriginal groups. So that idea that Aboriginal people might be more willing to engage with who they considered or defined to be outsiders rather than insiders. So partly that system was set up so that the detachments were always outsiders compared to whatever area they were working in. So weaponizing those existing ideas about inside and outside was part of that process. But for some of those descendants, it's just a process that probably won't ever be resolved.
No. I can understand that. The book is going to be available when? Soon.
Soon.
Published by?
University of Sydney Press.
Heather, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you, David.
I've been talking to Heather Burke, Professor in Archaeology at Flinders University, who is one of the co-authors with Lindley Wallace and Bryce Barker of Buried, Archaeology, Frontier Conflict and the Queensland Native Mounted Police. That's the show and the week, which means it's Chatterbox time when we read your emails, and please keep those emails coming in. The other day we were talking about the secession movements in Canada that never die. Quebec we knew about, but minerals-rich Alberta's wish to break free came as a bit of a surprise. So does the news from a keen listener that Gina Reinhart has big ambitions in Alberta. She's been trying for years to reopen the old Grassy Mountain coal mine in the Rockies, but so far the Canadian government has said no, no, no on environmental grounds. It's no surprise she's suing for $2 billion. My thanks to the Late Night Live team, producers Catherine Zengerer, Ali Benton, Anne Arnold and Julie Street, and our executive producer, Jack Schmidt.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.